Welcome to the Anonymous Andrew Modern Dating Podcast, your online compass for navigating the wide world of modern dating. Whether you're swiping left, swiping right, or meeting someone in the real world, I'm here to help you make the best choices on your journey to finding love. In this season, I'm diving deep into the world of dating apps, breaking down what makes a killer profile, and how to spot the red flags in others. We'll also explore how to connect with someone special in real life and the art of striking up a conversation that actually leads somewhere. We will also tackle the tough stuff, like healing from past relationships and learning how to build healthier, stronger connections moving forward. So whether you're new to the dating scene or just looking for fresh insights, join me as we explore the highs and lows of modern romance. It's time to swipe smart, date better, and find the love that truly fits. Welcome to another episode of the Anonymous Andrew Modern Dating Podcast, and I am really excited today. Today we have Bev Middleman. And Bev Middleman, well, let me welcome Bev. Bev, welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Andrew. Thank you. I'm so happy to be here with you and your audience.
I'll just give a little background on Bev. She's a certified relationship attachment and trauma practitioner. I couldn't read my handwriting. And the founder of something called Securely Love, which you'll tell us about. And from what in my research, she has an expertise in the attachment theory, in quotes. And I have loved the attachment theory ever since I heard it. So we'll dive into that. But Bev, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into this, and we'll go from there.
Thank you. So I have spent my entire career, more than 25 years now, in the field of personal growth, professional development. I'm one of those people that we call a lifelong learner. And at the same time, there were also a number of things that thought patterns that I had, my emotions that for a big part of my life, I didn't quite understand. And certain coping behaviors that I couldn't really get a grasp on. So I'm one of those people that kind of went out searching for answers. And I had, worked with different practitioners, tried different modalities. Years ago, I fell across this work on attachment styles. And when I started to understand it and apply it to my own self, I saw a breakthrough in my own thinking, my own level of anxiety and emotional regulation. Like, I just felt better and things started to click and it started to make sense. And at that point, I veered all my attention towards attachment styles. Wow. Because I said, this is where I need to be spending my time. Other people need to know about this. It is that impactful.
It is. I agree 100%. And I'm a recovering codependent as well as a recovering alcoholic. And they kind of go hand to hand because you have CODA, Codependence Anonymous, although I've never been there. But to have a certain type of, I guess codependency might be considered an addiction. You're addicted to people. You're addicted to love. You're addicted to, I always needed a woman on my arm. Mm-hmm. Why? I don't know. But I guess that's because, and we can get into this, maybe one of my attachment styles. And it wasn't until I learned about the attachment styles and I got out of the last relationship, I decided that I needed to change. So let's just tell the audience that Bev has a wonderful website and it is called the securelylove.com, right? That's the name of your, okay. And if you go to the website, there's a very easy to find a little but you can take the quiz on to find out your attachment style. So I did that, and I don't know if we're jumping ahead, but I just figured I'd get into it. I did that twice. I took the first one as if I was still in the last relationship, because the last relationship, I knew that I was walking on eggshells, that I was constantly chasing after her. She was always pulling away. She was always making me chase her down, and I was always putting her on a pedestal. So I took that quiz answering it as if I was 3 to 4 years ago. In the past 2 years, I've worked very hard on myself. I've stayed single. I've gone on some dates, but I have not been in a relationship. And then I went back to say, after the whole day, I went to work and I came back, and before we recorded, I took the quiz again. And this time I answered as if I was in a relationship today. I know that's kind of hard and maybe cheating, because I'm not in a relationship, but I answered the questions honestly as if I had a woman partner in my life. And I got two different answers, which which is not surprising. It's because of a lot of the work that I've done on myself. So the first time, to no surprise, it was anxious, preoccupied. And I knew that. I wasn't surprised. I was surprised that the second time around, I came up as secure.
I think it's wonderful.
Yeah.
And I applaud you. And it's such a beautiful illustration for those that are tuning in and listening to this. Attachment styles, first of all, everyone has them. Everyone has one. Yep. They have a primary and a secondary usually. So I always like to clearly establish that we are not talking about mental illness or personality disorders.
Correct.
Your attachment style is a set of learned behavior patterns that you've developed for how to engage with other people, emotionally bond with others, essentially how to give and receive love. And this was patterned into your mind at a very, very young age. Like, we are most suggestible as humans from 0 to 5. And so in those earliest years, what you would have experienced and felt and heard and seen would have etched in your mind a set of patterns, right? So it's very, very common that what we see is, as those children, of course, grow into adulthood, they take those patterns and they navigate the world using the same set of patterns that they once used in childhood. Now, all this is being done in the subconscious mind. So most people they're not aware of this, right? So what's beautiful about your situation is that you've recognized that, okay, because this is learned behavior, yeah, I could also
unlearn it. Yep.
And relearn it, right? So over the course of the last couple of years, you've invested time in understanding your own mind, your thought patterns, what your core wounds are, your limiting beliefs, and you've done that work. So now you've moved into a much stronger position in relationship to yourself. And when you choose that it's time for you to get into another romantic relationship, you're in such a better place to be, you know, a more authentic partner to that person.
I'll give you a good example, because in the past, I have to separate my past. So as I told you earlier, I'm in recovery from alcohol. So I'm 10 years sober. But during those 10 years, I did have 3 relationships, and all 3 were anxious attachment. And even though I had the 12 steps and a sponsor and a very good support system, I didn't use it. I was still, the patterns of behavior were still just from years and years of, I don't know if I want to blame the drugs or alcohol, or go back to, you were talking about your childhood, our childhood. My dad was never around, although he was a doctor. So he was working 14, 18 hours a day. And when he came home at night, it was like, you know, dad worked hard, leave him alone. And on the weekends, he would do his thing. But you know, I was the only son. I had 3 sisters. I always see the sisters got more attention than I did. So I already see the pattern of my childhood. Yeah. So, oh God, I just had a flashback. But in the last 2 years, Like, so a perfect example. I've been dating, but just going on dating apps, meeting women, texting with them, going on meet and greets, or sometimes, well, last week I had a date and we played pickleball and then we went to brunch. And the woman was lovely. She was really, I thought, just a nice woman. But at the end of the date, she said to me, not in these words, but I don't think we're a romantic match. I think we'd be best as friends. And I think 20, 15 years ago, even 10 years ago, that would have hurt. Or that would have said, see, I'm broken, you know? And I said to her, that's fine. And I would like to be your friend. And she lives out of state. And before she flew back home, she was visiting her parents. We went and played pickleball again. So the idea of being friends is possible. The point I'm getting at is that it was almost like she was establishing a boundary right up front. Like this, we came to meet as a romantic couple, but I don't feel it. And I said, that's fine. And I think as I thought about it more, I felt the same. I just didn't feel that there was a connection. The connection has to be two way, right? So
100%. Yeah. But that's the beauty of healing is that, you know, when we talk about core wounds, we can heal them. So your example is a beautiful one. When we have wounding as a child and we don't heal it, we pretend like it's not there. It's no different from any other wounds on our body. So I'll use an example let's say you're playing softball and someone throws the ball and hits you right in the arm really hard. So now you're bruised, it's tender, it's sore. Okay. 10 minutes later, you get back on the field, someone throws a ball and it smacks you right in the same place. Oh my God, that is going to hurt like hell.
Gonna sting.
Because there's already a wound there and it hasn't healed.
No.
Now, the next person who gets hit in the arm who didn't already have a wound, they'll just shake it off, right? No big deal. So the wounds that we have from childhood, if we haven't healed them, those become our triggers in adulthood. So when we're looking at people who fall into the camp of anxious preoccupied, they generally have wounds like, I am unlikable, I am unlovable, I will be excluded, I will be rejected, these types of things. So
you're going to get dumped. And that was,
I'm not good enough.
Correct.
These are really common ones that we see in people who have anxious preoccupied or anxious attachment. And so you could, it's not a leap to understand that if someone says, hey, Andrew, I'm not really feeling it, you know, let's just be friends, that could feel like a dagger to the heart because you already have a wound there. Right. Now, if I, for example, never grew up with that wound, so the wound that I grew up with was very different. I will be betrayed. It's a very different wound from I am unlikable or I will be excluded. In fact, I like being excluded. I'm more on the avoidance side of things. And so, you know, what will happen is, again, someone who doesn't have that particular wound, if I go out on a date with someone and they say, Bev, I'm not really feeling it, I go, okay, nice to meet you. Yeah. Like it has zero impact on me.
That's kind of how I felt. And you know, I got to be honest, I can't say that there wasn't a little disappointment because there's this 2 week buildup of texting and flirting online. And we did play pickleball that morning. It happened to be New Year's Day, and we got along great at pickleball. So going into the brunch, we went right out to brunch right afterwards, and things were flowing. It was like it felt good. And the day I've been on so many dates this past 2 years, it's like they kind of run into each other. My past behavior was always like if I got out of a relationship, whether I got dumped or I left or she cheated or whatever, I would jump into another relationship to not have to feel, not have to grieve, exactly. Not have to deal. Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
This time I'm not doing that. And I also am not settling. And there's some expression somewhere that somebody said it. If you don't want me, I don't want you. You know, like if,
right.
In other words, if I'm not good enough to be your partner, then I may be incorrectly saying it, but who was it? Groucho Marx said something about, I don't want to be in a club that wants me as a member. Something like that.
Have me as a member, right?
Right. Yeah. I'm looking for the next Mrs. Anonymous Andrew, and it's got to be the right choice. And anyway, I don't want to get off on my whole thing. What I would like is to, can we go through the attachment styles and yeah, list them? Because there are some people in the audience probably have heard of this, but they're not exactly 100% sure what they're all about. You do see them all over social media and people talking about it, but you're an expert and I'm a romantic podcast. So let's talk about each one and maybe explain a little bit about them.
Sure. I'd love to. Before we dive into that, I'm sure you've made the connection though. Like, you talked about your last girlfriend, how you were always sort of pursuing her and she was always distancing herself, and you were putting her on a pedestal. That sounds very similar thematically to how you described earlier on your father to me. So people often say to me, why do I always fall for the wrong person? It's not random. What we do as humans is we play out these patterns that we have in our mind. So even though that type of person is clearly wrong for you, it's the familiarity of the pattern that you are following. It feels right because that's all you know. You're used to chasing someone who's emotionally unavailable.
Is it true that we do attract... I've always attracted the wrong type of woman.
Right.
Explain that. Talk about how that works.
We're going to talk about those that are secure attachment and insecure attachment. But generally, if you're in the camp of insecure attachment, you will very likely attract another person who's also insecurely attached. And what people are doing, some people say, you know, you fall in love with your mother, your father. That's not entirely accurate. What you do is you end up picking people who feel familiar in terms of how you feel in their presence. It's the pattern, the familiarity that you're attracted to, because your subconscious mind goes towards what is familiar, not necessarily what is the best thing for you.
Correct.
Right. So you had a set pattern in your mind. You're chasing your father. You know, you're desperately wanting his love. That's how you knew love to be.
And my mom, by the way, my mom was a wonderful mom and she did the best she could. She raised four kids and she worked for my dad. But there were many times when mom had her hands full. And I put the burden more on dad.
But a child won't understand that. This is so interesting about this is that children don't develop the ability for critical thought until much later. So a young child, a 4 or 5 year old little boy, when they're trying to get their attention of their mother or their father and they can't for whatever reason, the child does not at that point in time have the ability to say, well, my mother's overworked and my father's emotionally unavailable. So, you know, the issue is on them. What the child does is they say, there must be something wrong with me. They always blame themselves and there must be something wrong with me, or they would pay me more attention. They would love me more. They would think I'm more likable. And what often happens in the case of those who are anxiously attached is they start to become very congenial. They start to become mama's little helper. They start to put everyone else's feelings ahead of theirs. And this is a way that they try to keep connection with other people. They become super friendly, very generous, always there to help everyone else. They become the people pleasers.
Right. Okay. Which I was. I pleased.
I have no doubt. So, and this was a pattern that would form in your mind to say that I need to really respond to other people and be concerned about other people before myself, because if I show someone my true self, they won't like me. Now, that's not true. It's not true, but in the right as an adult, it's not true. But in the mind of a child, the only thing the child is trying to do is survive.
Right.
And so we create all these maladaptations, and then our mind is almost like a computer. We store these programs and these patterns, and we just keep running them on autopilot, not realizing that 30, 40 years later, we're still running the old operating system.
Yep. We haven't upgraded, right? I was just going to say that.
Yeah. So that's what's so fascinating about this work. But let's break it down for your audience, really, what we're talking about here. So in general terms, we have two camps. Those that are in have a secure attachment style and those that have an insecure attachment style. Now, those that have a secure attachment style, they've come out of a home whereby there was a level of safety. There was a level of predictability, emotional attunement, right? So the child felt a sense of security and safety to be their authentic self. And knowing that, you know, their primary caregiver would respond to them in a healthy way. When we talk about a primary caregiver, where it's usually the mother, but certainly the father plays a role as well, a big role. And what happens in those earliest of years from 0 to 5, that's when we as humans are most suggestible. And so what you experience, hear, and see and feel in those years are so critically important. Right? Now, again, later experiences obviously can have an impact, but that initial pattern is set really, really young. Okay, so you're in a home, let's say, where not only are you getting 3 meals a day and a warm bed, that's important, but you're also getting the I love yous, the hugs. You're upset? Tell me why you're upset. I'm here for you. Talk to me. Right? Not everyone has that.
No.
Right? So these people who experience that in their earliest years, they grow up with a secure attachment style. And as adults, they do very well in forming connections with others, with family members, with colleagues, with friends, and they do especially well in romantic relationships. These are the people who generally are in long-term relationships. It doesn't mean that they don't have problems, but they have the skills to emotionally regulate, the skills to communicate, the skills to, you know, define their own boundaries, to understand their own needs. And so relationships just come easier for them.
Okay. I'm jotting down questions. So,
okay.
Yeah. All right. So there's two camps, secure, which is safety, predictability, emotional attunement. Then there's the insecure.
Yeah. So typically in North America, it's about a 50-50 split. Now, the statistics vary a little bit, but just for simplicity, we'll say half of the population has a secure attachment and the other half of the population has an insecure attachment, which means they came out of a home that was very different from what I just described.
Right.
So either they were dealing with parents, for example, who were emotionally unavailable, parents who were highly unpredictable, parents or an environment that was very, very chaotic, an environment that was abusive, an environment that was neglectful.
Alcoholic homes, father's cheating, never home, mother's
high conflict divorce, or a high demand religion, or, you know, you talk parents, people will say, my parents were very stoic. We never talked about feelings. Everything was swept under the rug, like it didn't happen, right? So these children, it was never modeled for them how to actually identify their feelings, how to connect to them, how to speak about them. Oftentimes, children in these environments would be heavily punished if they cried, right? So you can see how that sends a very different message to a child. Because if I'm going to get slapped across the face and I cry, you can be damn sure I'm not going to cry again in front of you.
Yeah. And I remember, not my dad so much, but I remember hearing growing up, if a child's crying, you'll hear the parents say, I'll give you something really to cry about, or, you know, something like, yep.
Yeah, right. And so the messages that we hear are critically important. So a child, for example, who is emotionally neglected, the child is crying and the mother says, stop crying or I'll give you something to cry about. Go to your room until you want to behave correctly.
Right.
Right. So the message there is terrible. Like feeling your emotions is somehow misbehaving.
Getting sent away from the dinner table. Go to your room, no dinner. And you're still being excluded from the family.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's so punitive, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because every child just wants to feel loved and included and accepted for who they are. So these are the roots of the insecure attachment. So, you know, the child who's often sent to their room and spends all this time alone because they have to work things out by themselves, they're the person that grows up with an avoidant attachment. So they learn to just repress their feelings and they learn that if my mother doesn't care that I'm upset, no one else is going to care. Right. It's me, myself, and I. I only have myself to depend on. And so they become quite detached from their feelings, and they have a very hard time with intimacy when they get older. Because the idea of being vulnerable and intimate with someone, emotionally intimate, is foreign to them. It was never modeled, right? So these are the people who in romantic relationships, they're very concerned, like they're very, very slow to warm up. They're very, very slow to make any sort of commitment. They're typically the type of people that are like, let's just keep it casual. Why would we have to put a label on anything? Why do we need any more? They're really afraid of making any level of commitment moving forward. What they're afraid of is being in a position where they might have to feel vulnerable, because that is a really, really scary to them. They don't know how to operate under that model. So you can see that there's a number of maladaptive strategies, behaviors that we adopt as a child that made sense back in the day. But then we move into adulthood and we want these beautiful, fulfilling relationships with the people in our life. Everyone, right? Our colleagues, our neighbors, our family, our romantic partners. And we struggle. Some things feel really, really difficult for us if we haven't addressed those core wounds.
What? And I'm just thinking back to the early days of the last relationship. There was a lot of trauma bonding. She was recently out of a divorce. She was married for 20 years. Her husband cheated on her, and she, to get revenge, she went on eHarmony, and that's when she met me. That was the first red flag that I should have realized that I should not have been dating her, because she was looking for revenge. by mishap, whatever, she fell in love with me. And because she actually said to me, I don't know if I can be a full-time boyfriend, and I'm just looking to get out and meet people. But we fell in love. But anyway, we sat on this very couch right here, and she would tell me all about her childhood and how her mother was abusive and abandoned her. She grew up in a third world country. And today she came to America, not today, 20 years ago, came to America, and she built a career for herself, got married, they bought a house. Did very well for herself, but she's broken inside because she hasn't resolved these exact things that you're talking about.
Yeah.
She had all of this insecure stuff going on as a child. So I wrote a question down that I was going to save for later, but it might be a good time to ask this. And I do want to get on to the next one. But is there any way to spot an insecure attachment style early on in the dating process, in the courtship process? So I meet somebody on Bumble, we chat, we text, and we exchange phone numbers. 5 days later, we're chatting. Are there any, I used to have a whole segment on red flags. Is there any red flags that we could look for that might say this person might have had a traumatic childhood, or this person would be has insecure attachment style or something?
Yeah. So, you know, typically someone's attachment style will start to come online and really show their true colors once there's a little bit of attachment bonding that's happening, which usually doesn't happen on date one or two.
Doesn't.
Right? So it could take a couple of dates, but one of the measures that I use is we know very well that people who have a secure attachment are typically not the folks who will demonstrate this emotional volatility, right? I'm up, I'm down, I'm crying, I'm sad, today's good, tomorrow's bad. People who have a secure attachment are generally pretty
stable.
They're stable. And so that's a measure. So what I do is I look for, you know, any sort of inkling of emotional dysregulation. And this is a little easier to spot. So first of all, if someone is newly out of a relationship, like they're just in the process of getting divorced, I typically will tell them, call me back in a year if I'm still single, then we can talk. Because we just know that the next year, they need to heal.
Yeah.
Someone who is in the middle of addiction, and you brought this up, who is addicted to their substance, who's working that out, they will, by virtue of the fact that they're in the middle of it, will be emotionally unavailable.
Yep.
And they will likely be volatile.
And we teach in the 12-step program, do not date within the first year. And there's a reason for that.
Right. There's a reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, what you're looking for when you're on a date is really someone who switches quickly. They're happy and then they're angry. They're mistreating, let's say, someone walks by and they say something very rude about them. Their phone rings, they're yelling into the phone. You're looking for these changes of emotional states.
I look at how this is maybe either cliche or not talked about enough. If I go on a date, I watch how they treat the wait staff.
Right. So that's what I meant. Someone walks by and they say something rude. Right. So that is definitely an indication. I've certainly, for example, gone out on a first date. I never accept for a man to pick me up, even though that's chivalrous. I just don't like it. But on a third date, I have said, sure, come and pick me up. He picked me up and all of a sudden he was driving like a maniac. I could see that he had the road rage. I could see it. And I looked at him and I said, at the next red light, I said, please drop me off. And I got off at the car because that's emotional volatility. You're calm and then you are revving. So there's an indication that something is dysregulated there.
Yeah.
So that's the easiest way to tell.
Yeah.
Now, you know, further down the road, where we can really see someone's attachment style, if you're trained and you're looking, is in how they're communicating and their approaches for dealing with stress and in conflict. So
within the relationship or outside or both?
Both.
Okay.
But the way in which someone would deal with a high stress environment or a high stress situation is very telling. So, for example, you and I are in a relationship and we have some argument. The topic doesn't even matter. And you're likely to say, you know what? We need to talk about this now. I can't go to bed knowing that we're angry. And I might turn around and say, I can't deal with this right now. I'm leaving. And then I ignore your call for the next 3 days.
I've had that. Yep.
I'm sure you have.
Yeah.
So those are the maladaptations that I was talking about. You're pushing forward these activating strategies because you were always seeking and striving to get the love of this person in your childhood. And me, on the other hand, as the pretend avoidance in this case, I was always left to my own devices. So the only way that I know how to regulate is to isolate myself. That's what I know. And so people who are unaware that they're repeating these patterns, they'll just say things like, well, this is just the way I am. When I'm upset, I need to be alone. Fair, that's your coping technique now. And oftentimes, again, what they'll do is they'll engage in a whole series of creature comforts. So maybe they'll lay in bed for 3 days. Maybe they'll binge watch Netflix. Maybe they'll overeat for 3 days. Maybe they'll lean on some of their other crutches, right? These folks are very, very, very ripe for addiction, right?
Social media is the new.
Alcohol comes in, or, you know, the next thing, they're at the casino, pornography is big. Addiction, you know, I always say addiction, it's never about the substance itself.
No.
What it's trying to do is pull you away from these uncomfortable feelings that you don't want to feel. It's a source of distraction, right? So yeah. What you're trying to do is give yourself a little dose of dopamine, a little bit of pleasure to offset the pain that you're feeling in that moment, because you've never been taught how to deal with that pain in another way.
Yeah.
You just ignore it, right? Now, you and I, Andrew, both know that if you ignore pain, it doesn't magically go away. It bubbles up to the surface in more aggressive ways.
I just had three health procedures this year. I had two hip replacements and a cardiac ablation. So I know what pain is. I just had a question. So if somebody, well, let's talk about the argument. You were talking about, like, if two people having an argument and one runs, like, I'm done, I can't take this, they run out, which happened to me. We would argue about something, or I would confront her on something because I was trying to establish a boundary and she didn't like that. And she would run out. And in my experience, when a woman runs out, she wants you to run after her. Is that or not? You shrug your shoulders. So
I shrug my shoulders because, you know, we tend to like to categorize things, because I think as humans, it helps us to understand, but we're far more nuanced as people,
okay,
right? So not every woman is going to want the same thing.
Correct. Fair point. Fair enough. Yeah, okay.
So I try not to paint everyone with the same brush.
Yeah.
Right. There would be maybe a cohort of men that want you to chase after them. Right. So it has more to do with how the strategies that they use to emotionally regulate. So, you know how you come towards your love interest, right? And you want to talk and you want to work things out and you don't want to be separated from them, right? That's an activating strategy. Those who are avoidant have deactivating strategies.
Right. Okay.
They disconnect, right? So I would say if you and I are arguing about something, and I say, Andrew, I need an hour to myself, and you run after me, that's not going to go well.
That's not good. I'm invading your space. And I have also learned over the years that sometimes during an argument, if one of you is level-headed, you call a timeout.
Yeah.
And you do take that. You say, and I did this once or twice with her. She would go in the bedroom and I would stay out here and we would set a timer for 15 minutes and cool off. And then try it again. And sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. So, okay.
Yeah. And so that's a beautiful time to use whatever techniques that you've learned over the years that serve you well in terms of regulating your emotions, right? So some people use like somatic techniques. There's certain things we can do with our body to bring our anxiety down, to regulate our emotions.
Deep breath,
breathing, you know, the vagus nerve. There are things we can do. Some people take a drive. Some people listen to music. Some people listen to a podcast. Some people go and exercise.
Right.
Some people take the dog for a walk. All of these little, you know, things that we do, that's the time to employ your strategy to calm down, right?
Okay.
Before you re-engage in a discussion. So that's a really, I love that you shared that. The timeout is important.
Yeah. And again, it didn't always work, but it depends on what you're doing in that timeout. So if you're just sitting there stewing, like.
Well, that's why I'm saying do something to bring your anxiety level down.
Correct. Yeah.
Right. Whatever that is for you. Some people really enjoy taking a hot steaming bubble bath. Great. I promise you, if that's something you enjoy, your mood will be different 30 minutes later.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay, we only touched on secure and insecure. We have, let's talk about the anxious, preoccupied, or pick one, dismissive, okay. Avoidant, fearful, avoidant.
Okay, so people often talk about that there are four attachment styles. There's actually two big camps. There's secure and insecure.
Right.
And within insecure, there are three subcategories.
Okay.
So within the insecure camp, then we already talked about sort of in broad strokes, you have the anxious preoccupied. And on the other side of the spectrum, because it's a spectrum, you have the dismissive avoidant. And then somewhere in the middle, you have the fearful avoidant.
Interesting. Okay.
All of these folks, again, didn't get the emotional attunement in their childhood that they needed, and they've created a set of patterns and behaviors for how to survive in this world. And what's common between all three of these in the insecure camp is they all have one core wound that is common, which is, I am unsafe.
Yes. Okay.
Right. And so whether you're anxious or you're avoidant or you're fearful avoidant, you have this sense that I am unsafe. And generally you have a degree of emotional dysregulation as well.
Okay. Because this podcast is about dating and this podcast has evolved. It used to be about learning the red flags of gaslighting and treating and all that. And then that was a year and a half ago. And then it merged into learning how to live in my own skin. It's kind of like my journey, but I took everybody along with me with guests and coaches and stuff. And this year we're now that I'm in a much better place and I really want to get out and start intentionally dating. All the dates that I went on 18 months ago or six or eight, whatever, even 6 months ago, I was just doing it for the podcast, for practice, or just.
Well, your criteria is going to change. Now that you yourself have moved towards, you've done this work
yes.
to invest in your mind, and you've moved towards a person who's much more securely attached, like you've let go of some of those old patterns around being anxiously attached. What you're going to want as a partner is going to be very different. You're no longer going to accept
yes.
someone who is avoidant or who is stonewalling, or because this doesn't align to your needs today.
So I think where I was going was because I like to focus on the dating apps. One of the concepts about modern dating is that it's a clusterfuck. It's just, there's too many apps, too many people on the apps, and they're not treating each other fairly. There's all this ghosting and zombieing and all this stuff. One of the underlying themes of the podcast is how to navigate this crazy modern dating society we're in. So whether you're meeting in real life or you're meeting on a dating app, and we talked about this earlier, attracting the wrong type of person. How does one, starting from their dating profile or walking through a supermarket, how do you not only attract the right person, but pick the right person? I'll give you an example. There's a woman at my grocery store that I find attractive. And for some reason, I think the universe is putting us together, because every Saturday morning at 11:15 is when I go shopping. She's there every Saturday, and she's beautiful and gorgeous, and I've yet to have the courage to walk up to her. Mm-hmm. But I think I'm not doing it. There's a couple of underlying reasons. She might be a little too young for me. I'm 60. She might be in her 40s. So I it's fear. But how would we identify somebody? I don't know if we can. I don't know if there's an answer, but we don't want to find somebody who's fearful avoidant. I watch her dodge around the supermarket. Like you talked about this guy driving like crazy in the car. This woman, when she goes shopping, I've never seen somebody fill up their basket so quickly. It's like zip, 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 you know, and I'm just strolling along looking, and it's beautiful to watch because she's attractive. But something went off in my head and goes, she's kind of manic. It's almost like she's like zing, 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 zing. And what's the rush?
Right. So I would say to you, first of all, trust your instincts, right? Yeah. We don't give ourselves enough credit, especially when we come into the physical space of another person, your body often sends you little signals.
Right.
So, you know, one thing that Disney got wrong was the whole butterflies thing, right? Like when you fall in love, you feel butterflies in someone's presence. The butterfly thing actually is usually an indication. It's usually a trauma response where I feel nervous around the person. That's not what you want.
No,
that's not that. The butterflies is like something's off. My intuition's telling me that this is something isn't good. It's triggering my anxiety. So, you know, if you have that type of response, something feels off, listen to it because your body doesn't lie.
What then? Let's look at the opposite of that. So if you're around somebody that either you're attracted to or you admire romantically, what should you feel? Because when I see this woman the first time, before I started seeing her dodge around the store, I felt warm. I felt fuzzy. Yeah, I felt like I was floating. I was like, wow, look how beautiful. And I just, time moved slowly. Maybe that's why I didn't see her zipping around, because time was moving very slowly.
Right.
So are those the hormones? Is that the oxytocin? Is that, what is that?
It could be a number of things, but you know, what it is that your body's telling you, you feel safe in that person's presence.
Okay.
Right. So you talk about warm and fuzzy. When you come home and you want comfort, you lay on the couch and you drape a big fuzzy blanket over yourself to get that warmth and that cozy, and you feel safe. If you feel the same sensations in the presence of someone else, that means that you feel safe in their presence. That's a really good green flag.
Great.
And you can feel excited, but there's a difference between excited and nervous, right? If someone makes you feel nervous around them, like you're walking on eggshells, that's not the right sensation.
Yeah. No. And I've done that not once, but multiple times, and I know the feeling and I never want to feel it again. So
yeah,
no.
it's a difficult one. But generally when I'm trying to get to know someone, like at the really, really early dating stage, I will ask a couple of direct questions. Now, this is not for everyone, but I'm sharing what I do. By the way, I was married a long time. I was married 23 years. I've been separated about 4 years now. So I too have, you know, I guess the same challenges with dating. It's like the wild, wild west.
You're
right?
On the dating market and it's crazy, right? It's crazy out there. Yeah.
It is a little bit insane. But there's two questions I like to ask. Tell me about your mom. Right.
Oh, okay. Are you asking me, or you're asking like you? No, I would ask the person.
Right. It's a question that I ask my date.
Oh, okay.
Tell me about your mom and tell me about your ex. And lots of dating people, coaches will say, don't talk about your ex on the first date. I want to know about your ex.
Why?
I don't actually want to know about your ex. I want to know how you characterize them. I want to hear whether.
Me
that it was all their fault,
right?
And they had this issue and they were a narcissist and it wasn't me, I was perfect. The minute I hear that, you're not for me. You have not done the work. You don't understand that at a minimal you pick this person.
It takes two people. Absolutely. So while they might be a narcissist or they might have one of these negative attachment styles, this last relationship that I was in, I take full responsibility for because I allowed this behavior to go on and on and on. And I can't, I had a support group around me and I would call them every night and tell them she did it again. She didn't show up last night. I think she's sleeping with somebody, yada, yada. And they would say to me, why are you putting up with this? You know, and I have no answer. I would have no answer. Because she's beautiful, I'll never find somebody as beautiful as her, yada, yada, yada. And so if you ask me about my ex, I would say she was not a good person, but I stayed too long. This is the phrase, I stayed way past the expiration point, and it was my fault.
And so that shows that you have a level of insight. that you've done some work, that you have emotional intelligence. And so that's what I'm looking for. Now, there's another interesting thing that I do on my dating profile.
Oh, tell me.
So my biggest wound from childhood is, I've mentioned this before, is betrayal. And betrayal is the top core wound for someone who's fearful avoidant. So these are folks who typically come out of homes where they were abused. And in romantic relationships, they're often characterized as the hot and the cold partner, which means they want closeness, but they're also really petrified of intimacy. Because okay. when they were a child and they sought the comfort and safety of their caregiver,
it was rejected.
No, not just rejected. The caregiver was harming them.
Oh.
Physically, psychologically, emotionally, could be sexually. It was not sexually in my case. But you could imagine that the child becomes very disorganized in their mind. There's one person in this world who can give me the love and comfort I need. And it's also that same person who's harming me. And so as an adult, it becomes very difficult to trust others and be truly intimate with someone. There's a fear of intimacy there. So that's the fearful avoidant. The biggest trigger, the biggest core wound being, I will be betrayed.
So you started this conversation with, I put in my profile.
Yes, I would. That's the backstory. So even though I am at this point in time, far more securely attached, as I've invested in my own work as well.
Both of us.
But that betrayal wound still is there. So one of the things that I do is I look very early on to see whether someone is lying to me. I have zero tolerance for lying.
Me too.
I like authenticity, transparency. Do not lie to me. And some people lie just as a sport. Like there's no reason. So here's what I do. I actually write a very detailed profile. And I know that most people are just looking at the pictures and they're not reading.
Right. Men are visual. But go ahead.
But in that, if you're going to write to me, please read my profile first.
Agreed.
So the last line in my profile says, I'm looking for someone who has read my entire profile. Please send me a flower emoji if you have. Otherwise, I will not respond.
Interesting.
And so what happens is I get dozens of messages. Hey, what's up? Hey, how's your day? Hey, how's it going? I know they haven't read my profile.
Because there's no flower.
There's no flower. Now, if there is someone interesting, I might give them a second chance and go, with all due respect, I'll say to them, nice to meet you. Can I ask you a favor? Sure. With all due respect, can you kindly please read my profile? Okay. They come back and they go, okay, I read it. They're lying to me.
They haven't sent you the flower. I like that.
They're lying to me. And at that point, it's a no-go.
Would that work in the reverse gender? Like if I did that?
Yeah.
Because women, I think, from my experience and study and research and talking to people, they will read a guy's profile.
Yeah, I read everything because your personality, for me anyways, is more important to me than what you look like.
Right.
Which.
Yes.
But for men, it might be, and not all men, right? Because it's not everyone's the same.
No.
But someone who's just concerned about your physical appearance, they don't really care what you wrote. They're also the ones that are very, very, very likely just want a casual fling.
Yeah,
and that's not what I want.
That's
so,
not what I want either, no.
Right. And so, I think that it's an easy, fun way to tell. So as soon as someone sends me, hi, Bev, with a flower, I know they've read my profile.
That's good.
They're not going to say to me, hey, want to come over later and Netflix and chill? Because when I get those messages, like...
No. You know what they're looking for, and it's not...
Yeah.
No. I'm going to steal that, but I have to tweak it to... I don't want a flower emoji, but I want them to know that they read. Because my profile, I crafted carefully. That was a tongue twister. And... Yeah, I like to know that they read through the entire profile. Mm-hmm. you know, like I have the fact that I'm sober is on there and it's important. Fact that I have tattoos. There was one or two women that when they met me, she says, "Oh, you have tattoos?" And I'm like, "Did you not either?" Because the profile says it and the pictures show it. And
right.
So clearly you did not go through the profile. So
right. And I find it disrespectful. If you're going to connect with me, let's see if we're aligned on some of the basic stuff first.
Yeah.
No judgment. If you want something casual, I'm just not your match.
Right.
Now, I'll tell you something funny. Instead of a flower emoji, I used to use a unicorn. I used to say, "Send me a unicorn." But then I had a whole bunch of couples that were sending me a unicorn because they thought I was advertising myself as a unicorn. And I was like, okay.
And that's polyamory.
A unicorn is a single woman that will join in the bedroom between a couple, right?
Wow.
As a third. And so that was not what I was trying to do, but it was kind of funny. So I had to change from a unicorn to a flower.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the flower is nice. I many times will, when I say send the first message, it will be a rose, or maybe I think one of the emojis is a bouquet. It may not be a rose, but it's a bouquet. It's just I like emojis and I'll use them. Whatever. So, all right. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, but I want you to give us a little bit of synopsis of your practice and tell people where they can find you. And 5 minutes, go.
Thank you.
Tell us all about you.
So my entire practice is focused on attachment, trauma, and relationships, right? So helping to move you towards secure attachment. My website is securelyloved.com.
It is.
On my website, we talked at the beginning of the hour that there is a free quiz. I think that's a great place to start for to get an idea. It's free. It's confidential. I don't get the results. It's just for you.
And I like that because a lot of times I've taken these things and you have to sign up first, which means you're going on an email list and you didn't do that. I like that.
Thank you. No. Yeah. I really, my driver here is to get people to, you know, understand attachment styles and learn about it. So I'm not trying to collect your email or any of that. I do offer a free 20-minute consult if you're interested in working with us. I say us because it's a practice.
Practice.
There's a number of practitioners working. It's not just me. So you can read our bios and see which one you're most aligned to.
Where are you based?
Well, we work just virtually.
Okay. All right.
We work just virtually. So actually the practitioners are based in different cities, but it's almost irrelevant.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's also some other great resources on the website. We do have social media. I'm on YouTube. I'm on Instagram. My grown-up children. I have two sons. They're 18 and 20. They taught me TikTok. So Securely Loved is now on TikTok.
And I'll put all of that in the show notes. And I think I followed you already.
Thank you.
If I haven't, I'll be following you shortly. So I'll put all of your social media, your website, in the show notes. And to the audience, please take the test, the quiz. It's fun. Her website is nicely laid out. It's very comfortable, very easy to navigate. I think you should go to the website. I think it's great.
Thank you so much.
Any parting thoughts or last minute thoughts that maybe we didn't get a chance to cover you want to emphasize?
You know, the tagline for my company, Securely Loved, is love isn't blind. Love is learned.
Interesting. I like that.
And so, you know, we really can learn how to interact with ourselves and with others in a way that allows us to be more authentic, more genuine, and really just more intimate with the people that matter to us the most. So this work, it's well worth doing. I thank you for helping me spread the word about attachment styles.
I thank you. I really haven't had on somebody who was a real expert on the attachment styles, and I'm glad we got a chance to go through them. So Bev, thank you so much for joining me. I'd like to thank Bev Middleman very much for stopping by. And I've always had a thing for the attachment styles theory. Well, it's not a theory. It's a real thing. But she explained it very well. And I really encourage you to go on her website and take that little quiz. It'll tell you your attachment style. It's pretty cool. And you know what else is pretty cool? If you enjoyed this episode or any of my episodes, go down below if you're on Apple or Spotify and leave a review. And maybe share this show with a friend. And I can also use a little help, folks. This podcast is coming up on 2 years and it's costing me out of pocket. So I could use a little help. In the show notes, you'll see buy me a cup of coffee. And that's not literal, of course. You just click on it and you donate $5 to the show. And I will leave it at that. Thank you very much for listening. And until next week, ciao.